From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Today, South Korea's leaders said they saw President-elect Donald Trump's Twitter blast at North Korea as a clear warning. Trump's tweet was responding to North Korean leader Kim Jong-un's New Year's Day announcement that his country is in the final stages of preparing to test an intercontinental ballistic missile that could reach parts of the U.S. Trump's response, it won't happen. Trump also tweeted that China wasn't helping enough to curtail North Korea. China, in essence, said the country's leaders would not respond to tweets. But will North Korea's leader, and how will he respond? We're joined by Here and Now security analyst Jim Walsh. He's with MIT Security Studies Program. And Jim, we've spoken here before about national security and Donald Trump's tweets. So you have South Korea today saying that Donald Trump sent a clear message with his it won't happen regarding North Korea. Was Trump's message clear to you?
Well, no. As often happens with 140 characters, it seems as if it was vague and not clear. The North Koreans announced that they were going to test an intercontinental ballistic missile, an ICBM. Mr. Trump's tweet referred to a completed nuclear weapon. Now, so was his tweet about the upcoming test? Was it about something that's supposed to happen further down the road?
And what does he mean by it won't happen?
Well,
I mean, is that a threat? And
sounds like a red line to me. Yeah. And this is another reason why I continue to emphasize to the president-elect that national security and foreign policy is different than an election campaign and not really made for Twitter. So if you blurt out a red line, and let's say they go ahead and test anyway, because what are you going to do to stop them? Then suddenly you've established a red line and it's been crossed, and now what? At a minimum, it makes you look bad, and it's easy to get the facts wrong. And again, I think when he's tweeting, he's thinking about Americans, America is his audience, and forgets there's South Korea and Japan and China and all these other people who are also watching. And while the South Korean government may have said, yes, we support you, they don't really have much choice there, the New York Times reported that it's made people uneasy. Remember, if there's a fight over North Korea, the battleground is not going to be Ohio or Oklahoma. It's going to be Seoul. Mm-hmm. So when you make threats and presumably are going to back them up, if that leads to warfare, it's the South Koreans and those American troops in South Korea that are going to be engaged in that fight. And that makes people nervous.
Look, we're talking about a part of the world, North Korea, in which there, you know, it's a different reality and a different view of reality. Do you have any fear that when someone says it won't happen, that there's a hunkering down? Or is there a mindset in North Korea, from your extended knowledge of the country, is there a mindset where they know that that's just talk? Or is there possibly, you know, someone there thinking, he's going to come and stop us somehow?
Well, we have a strange alignment of the stars right now where leadership in both countries tends towards bluster and exaggeration. I think at the end of the day, the North Koreans are pretty rational in the sense that, yes.
Really? That's
yes.
A sentence I never thought I'd hear from you, and you've been there.
Yes. And the reason why I say that is history. They're provocative, but they've learned to adjust their provocations so they never cross the threshold where it leads to war. Why? They know if there's a war, they're going to lose. And the thing that Kim wants to do is hold on to power. So they don't want to have an actual war. What they want to do is sort of stay below that threshold, provoke, you know, try to gain some leverage. So they've changed their provocations over time, which would seem to suggest they sort of get it. They sort of see where the line is and stay below that line. But there can be miscalculation. There can be mistakes made. So this is a dangerous game.
And what about Trump taking on China for not helping enough to curtail North Korea? Is China a part of whatever is rational about North Korea's thinking? Is China whispering in that potentially rational ear?
Well, I think absolutely Mr. Trump is right to say that China is a pivotal player. None of this is going to be solved without China's help. The error I think he and some of his colleagues make is this notion that if we're going to get China to help with us, what we should do is threaten them. You know, getting a country to cooperate by threatening them, that just seems like a contradiction to me. We need to talk with China, get on the same page, and work cooperatively so that we are able to demonstrate to North Korea it is not in their self-interest to go down that path. But us wagging the finger at China isn't going to make it easier to cooperate. It's going to make it harder cooperate.
But to what extent is China? I mean, and is Donald Trump right that China's not helping to curtail North Korea?
Well, China has signed off on the last several UN Security Council resolutions. They did crack down on some of the trade and imports earlier this month. Would we like to see them do more? Yes. But they've got their own national security dilemmas here. They don't want a failed nuclear weapon state on their border, and they're trying to keep an hand outreach to North Korea. They don't want to see that relationship blow up and then suddenly have a nuclear weapon state who could threaten them. So they're having to balance several different things. They're doing more than they did in the past, but yes, there's more they can do.
And just briefly, what is being done right now is sanctions over human rights abuses and other actions. The President Obama refused to negotiate with North Korea. Are we seeing a Donald Trump that may? I mean, he sort of is on Twitter.
Well, I think we're going to see – he's talked about sanctions, but I think the problem right now – again, I want to underline, he has no cabinet. He has no national security staff. He should probably wait, you know, another month before doing all this. But I expect that he will pursue a sanctions policy.
Well, I mean, what about negotiations? Yes or no? No?
He said he would, and he said he wouldn't. So anybody knows.
Jim Walsh here, now security analyst with MIT Security Studies Program. Thanks as always.
Thank you.
Well, immigration was a major issue in the presidential election, of course. And since then, some immigrants to this nation have become U.S. citizens. So Sam Brash from Here and Now contributor Colorado Public Radio went to a recent naturalization ceremony to find out how those new Americans felt about becoming citizens in a nation where concerns about immigration run high. Here's his story.
All right. If I can have all of our candidates for citizenship, please raise your right hand in the air.
46 people stand together in the ceremony room of the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services field office near Denver. They're here from all across Colorado. Andy Lambrecht directs the office. He leads them through the Oath of Allegiance, their final stop on a path to citizenship full of paperwork, lawyers, and hundreds of dollars in filing fees. Many of their voices waver and hands shake, but they all hold through until the very last line.
For purpose of evasion.
For purpose of evasion.
So help me God.
So help me God.
Congratulations, you're now American citizen.
Family and friends rush the new citizens as soon as the ceremony ends. Among them, 56-year-old Julio Martinez. He coaches soccer and works as a technician at a meat processing plant. He wept as he hugged his wife, kids, and grandkids.
I waited all these years for this. It's just something that I had to do for my mom and my dad. So I owe that to them. And this is the moment. This is why I feel so emotional.
Martinez's parents brought him from Mexico when he was 9 or 10. He can't remember exactly when. They always wanted him to be a citizen, as did his American-born wife and kids.
I have always been very proud of my dad for taking this long journey.
This is his daughter, Priscilla Johnson. Now 34, she remembers her dad starting his paperwork for citizenship when she was just a little girl. He kept putting it off because of health issues and the cost.
Now is finally the time after his mom and dad just recently passed away, my grandma and grandpa, within the last year. And I think that was the wake-up call to be able to say, you know what, this is what they wanted for me, so I'm going to finally do it.
Johnson wanted her dad to get a citizenship for one other reason. She was worried about President-elect Donald Trump.
The election did scare me, because you never know what laws are going to change or what was going to be stopping him from becoming a U.S. citizen. So I was worried and was hoping that he was going to be able to have that chance to vote.
Are you going to register to vote today?
Probably. Yeah.
Across the country, the Immigration Service saw an increase in applications for citizenship this year compared to last. Some groups suggested that was a reaction to Trump, but the trend wasn't reflected in Colorado. Approved applications for naturalization in the state have seen normal fluctuations over the last 2 years. And if this one ceremony was any indication, not all new citizens fear the incoming president.
My name is Ronald Shaw. I've been a green card holder for years, and I'm happy to be receiving my U.S. citizenship today.
Shaw came to the U.S. from India in 1966 to attend university. He earned a doctorate in education and worked in private Christian schools. He wanted to get his citizenship to make it easier to travel abroad. He's retired now, but he still goes to Southeast Asia to teach leadership principles, many of which he admires in the president-elect.
He's a leader. His election has been a very clear message to all that what was happening in the U.S. over the last few years has to change.
Shaw would have voted for Trump if he'd been eligible. Like other Trump supporters, he worries many newcomers aren't interested in assimilating.
Some immigrants come with pre conceived ideas, or they have been brainwashed in certain ways. So they did not come here for a better life. They came here to destroy this life, in a sense.
Shah and Martinez sat next to each other during the ceremony. They chatted beforehand and congratulated each other afterwards. America the Beautiful played as the ceremony ended. The Martinez family planned to celebrate.
We actually are probably going to go to lunch, have a big lunch.
It's already a good day today. This just happened. I can't believe it, and it's just awesome.
Ronald Shah also left for a meal with his family and a few friends from his church. These new citizens told me that, at least for today, politics is not a priority for them. Whatever happens to the country next, they're just happy to be part of it. For Here and Now, I'm Sam Brash in Denver.
As we anticipate an inauguration and new leadership, we're thinking Beethoven. Beethoven began composing the Eroica Symphony inspired by Napoleon Bonaparte, then a hero of the French Revolution. But by the time the piece was finished, Napoleon had crowned himself emperor and begun to wage war across Europe. Beethoven was said to be outraged, tearing Napoleon's name off his manuscript, dedicating the piece not to a great man, but to the memory of a great man. Classical music writer Fran Hoffner writes for The All and will occasionally help us deconstruct classical pieces. Her recent column is titled, Let's Finally Talk About Beethoven. She joins us now from WBEZ in Chicago. Welcome back.
Thank you so much for having me back.
Well, it's interesting. We had a lot of suggestions after we deconstructed a piece with you a while back, and Beethoven was on that list. And we should thank you because at the beginning of your column, you reveal that you found out, as many did, that it's the Eroica Symphony, but it has nothing to do with eroticism.
Yeah, we played the third movement when I was in high school, and I always thought Eroica was just like a German or something phrase for erotica. It's like what it looked like to me as a 15-year-old. So I was
like,
oh,
excited.
This is Beethoven's. Yeah, I was like, oh, it's his erotic symphony. But that has nothing to do
because
with
it,
the piece at all.
It means what?
Heroic symphony.
Yes, heroic symphony. And is it about Napoleon? Did he see Napoleon as a hero?
He did when he started. And as Napoleon kind of very quickly got worse and worse, not only did Beethoven sort of second-guess this, but one of his patrons essentially said, like, I won't continue to support you if you dedicate this symphony to Napoleon.
Okay.
So he withdrew. By the time it debuted, it was withdrawn.
Your sense of Beethoven, because you're very honest in your columns, you wondered if it was bad that your go-to image for Beethoven is the angry, deaf, old man with wild hair that John Cleese made famous in his Monty Python skit. This is about the Fifth Symphony. Let's listen. So who is this Beethoven that we're meeting at this time? You know, maybe a rock star, but also maybe, as we just heard, losing his hearing.
Yeah, I see him so much less as an angry figure. I think that's just sort of an easy go-to. In college, we actually read, it's not quite a suicide letter or a will, but it's sort of a letter to his two brothers about 2 years before the Eroica came out, basically saying that he wants to die and his loss of hearing is really sort of pulling him down, and composing is the only thing that's sort of pushing him forward. He says, like, I'm doing this for my art. And he uses the word art over and over again instead of music.
Well, let's listen to what he did. The first two chords in E flat. You say this is your favorite movement. Why?
Yeah, I love it. It's such a complete picture, and it runs at about 16 minutes, which at the time is sort of what the length of a normal total symphony was. So to have this really grandiose, incredibly long opening that's just sort of like, here's where we're starting, it essentially, I mean, this being his third symphony, but also sort of the start of the middle section of his career, really rewrote what a lot of classical composers were doing at this time. It feels very revolutionary just to listen to.
Well, but let's listen to a little more of the first movement, Allegro con Brio.
This is like a fanfare about a big idea, which had not yet been done. It was before, it was just, here's my melody, and here are a couple different ways we can sort of work through it. To start on this really bright note and to know that it's for a great man, I think, says everything about sort of what the symphony's about.
Well, but then the second movement is a funeral march. Let's listen to a little bit.
Yeah.
Napoleon had not died yet. So what is that?
I mean, I think this is him looking ahead into the future at what he imagines maybe this like death of democracy to be, perhaps also sort of a funeral for the old way of doing things, sort of the monarchy and something like that. When Napoleon did die, someone reached out to Beethoven, who is still alive, and he was like, yeah, I wrote that piece 17 years ago, so you know what piece to use for his funeral. But it's gone down as one of the most famous sort of funeral marches.
Well, as you write, the funerals of FDR, JFK, F. Scott Fitzgerald's deathbed, it was played. So obviously it resonates. Well, let's move on to the third movement. Beethoven wrote the symphony in a cottage in the Viennese countryside. And the third movement starts out kind of courtly. This is, what would you say, more traditional?
Yeah.
Everybody dance. And then they suddenly are at the end of this movement. There's a country dance at the end. But how does this fit in the Napoleon theme?
That's a good question. I have a hard time placing this movement. Maybe just as a general celebration of the people, it feels definitely more about sort of a common man than it does perhaps Napoleon himself. Maybe sort of the reflection of what life under Napoleon should have been like, as Beethoven wanted it to be.
Yeah. Let's go to the final movement, the Allegro Molto. Let's listen just to the beginning. Now, that feels almost like a joke, almost, like somebody's tiptoeing. Or
it's a very funny change of pace to me to start with this sort of big, intense, string and horn fanfare, and then to take it back down immediately. Pizzicato on the strings with the woodwinds kind of chiming in. It's sort of him announcing sort of like, this is going to be the end, but I'm gonna build you up. You don't get to like have that big loud part unearned.
Well, and talk more about how this was received at the time. I mean, people were confused.
To immediately go from this very sort of bright and exciting intro to the funeral march to a dance, I mean, it was probably just very confusing and very difficult to focus on.
Mm. So we want to hear the very end, because as you write, the last 2 minutes of the piece are just like, if you don't like Beethoven, what's wrong with you? Let's listen.
I mean, it's so hard for me to be glib or funny about Beethoven, sort of like Monty Python impersonation aside, because his music is so approachable and recognizable, even if you're not familiar with classical music. He essentially rewrote what classical music was to a point where we now consider Beethoven the standard. And in that final 2 minutes, you're sort of filled with this sort of immense joy and optimism. And that is sort of like the happy part of Beethoven that I feel is what should be remembered instead of this very like gloomy, angry man.
Well, we started off by saying that we're thinking of leadership, and he was too, mm-hmm. apparently. I mean, he credited to Napoleon, then he took it back when Napoleon became so controversial. He had a complex Napoleon.
Yeah.
But Hitler also loved Beethoven's music. He called it music that reflected the heroic German spirit. Beethoven wasn't banned by the Israeli Philharmonic as Wagner was, because that was Hitler's favorite composer.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it gets complicated when you start thinking about what are the composers thinking about leaders.
I mean, it's very tough because I think so many composers love the idea of democracy or sort of a ruling power that favors art and artists, which it so often when it goes bad, they do not favor art and artists. I've been thinking a lot about Shostakovich recently, who I've been listening to a lot of, who sort of constantly fell in and out of favor with Stalin just while his career was happening. Mm-hmm. It's interesting that Beethoven wrote for Napoleon more or less, but the two men never interacted, and Beethoven could never know that his stuff was going to be reappropriated by Hitler. You kind of have to like make art and hope for the best that it doesn't end up in the wrong hands or thought of to mean something that it doesn't.
Hmm. Fran Hoffner writes The Classical Music with Fran column for The All. We'll link you to her column on Beethoven at hereandnow.org. Fran, thanks as always.
Thank you so much, Robin.
It's Here and Now. And 2017 may be a good year for some renters. Now, in a number of cities across the country, there's now a glut of luxury apartments, so some landlords are bringing down rents. In New York, some developers are even offering 3 months rent-free. In Houston, some are waiving security deposits. Jason Bellini of the Wall Street Journal joins us from New York. He's taking a look at this. Hi, Jason, and Happy New Year.
Hi. And Happy New Year to you, Robin.
And we read that in New York, where you are, there are around 30,000 new luxury apartments being built. In Dallas, there are 24,000. Now, we know the move to build these apartments was a response to young people who didn't want to own a home. They wanted to move into the city. But mm-hmm. do we now have a bubble?
I don't know if we describe it as a bubble, but we could use the flood analogy, just a flood of new apartments. You know, the number of upscale apartments that came on the market appeared to outpace the number of renters that are able to afford to move into them. Here's a stat for you. According to MPF Research, more than 50,000 new units were rented by tenants in the fourth quarter, but that demand was overwhelmed by 88,000 new units that were completed in the quarter. Mm. And we should point out that's the most since the mid-1980s.
Yeah.
So a big gulf there between in supply and demand at
right.
the moment.
And you say because of that, the rents are heading down. But they're still in probably the stratosphere for a lot of people because they went up so high. Again, this tracking group showed that rents in the U.S. have increased nearly 30% since 2010. So, I mean, isn't it true that what went up so high had to come down?
True, but it hasn't come down that much.
Right.
I mean, there's a to be sure
right.
here, and that is, you know, rents in San Francisco, New York, Houston, San Jose, California, they only declined about a percentage point from year to year in 2016. So, I mean, landlords, they're pretty reluctant to bring down rents. You're lucky in cities like these if they just keep your rent the same as it was the year before.
Yeah, they may not raise it. And again, if it comes down, maybe that was a false headline there because it's still going to be pretty expensive. And what does this do? In most major cities, if you look around, you can see this building going on. What does it do to the cities that desperately need affordable housing?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And as you correctly point out, most of the new construction has been on the high end. I mean, we're talking about buildings that typically offer amenities galore, fitness centers, yoga studios, media rooms, swimming pools, all nice amenities I would love to have. And over 80% of new properties were in luxury category. But, you know, now that there's this glut, eventually they're going to have to start building for people who can't afford that. And so I think the market forces are likely to lead to fewer of these new, you know, real fancy buildings and potentially more affordable type buildings for
right.
people who just can't afford all those luxuries.
Right. I mean, you know, obviously if they don't have enough people to buy the luxury units, maybe the thinking will be start some of the more affordable units. But meantime, what happens to those luxury units in the few seconds that we have?
Well, what happens to them is the owners do what they can to get people to get in there, as you mentioned earlier, giving, you know, a free several months rent and other kind of perks to get people to right. sign a lease. And right. they're going to be forced, in some cases, to take a loss.
In Los Angeles, there's a lot of free parking going on with your rental. Jason Bellini of The Wall Street Journal taking a look at the rental world. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Robin.
When Dr. Raj Panjabi returned to his home country of Liberia back in 2005, civil war had wiped out much of the medical infrastructure in the country of 4 million people. In fact, there were only 51 doctors in all of Liberia. So Panjabi vowed to create an army of community health workers in Liberia to rebuild that infrastructure and to prevent what he called anonymous deaths. He was awarded the $1 million 2017 TED Prize for his efforts. Dr. Raj Panjabi is the CEO and co-founder of Last Mile Health and an associate physician at Harvard Medical School. And I spoke with him recently and began by asking him to tell us about his native Liberia.
I had been privileged to be born there, fled during the conflict as a child, went back as a medical student about 12 years ago. And when I got back home, it was just devastating. You know, you expect physical destruction after war, and we had a lot of that. I mean, even as far as no traffic lights, no running water, no electricity in the capital city where I'd grown up. We also had a lot of human devastation. We just had 51 doctors, again, to serve a country of 4 million people. What that meant was if you got sick in the city where those doctors were primarily clustered, you might stand a chance. But if you got sick in remote rural communities where I had been asked by the Ministry of Health to work in, you would often die anonymously. I mean, that's because if you fell sick, as a imagine a two-year-old falling sick with a fever, mom would have to take you to a riverbed, get in a canoe, and walk, sometimes up to 2 days, just to get a diagnosis in a clinic.
Huh. And of course, then this problem, the effects of this problem were only exacerbated unimaginably by the Ebola crisis.
Well, and that's right, and in many ways related to them. So we know that right after the war, Liberia public spending was about $3 per person per year. I mean, you know, the U.S. is spending several thousand dollars per person per year in comparison. We had increased that spending tenfold up until the crisis in 2014, but those dollars and the investments had not reached the remote rural corners of the country. We know that because even across the border from us in southern Guinea, a two-year-old named Emil would come down with what would turn out to be Ebola, but it took 3 months between December 2013, March 2014 for it to be diagnosed and confirmed. And partly that's because there's a lack of a health worker in those communities and a lack of a health system to support that health worker. So, you know, what we've learned working in Liberia after the war, but also during the Ebola crisis, is that the fault lines of inequality, the lack of the maldistribution of healthcare services and health workers, lines up a lot with the fault lines of poverty and mm-hmm. the fault lines of where globalization has not reached. They've not reached rural communities.
Yeah. So, of course, the Ebola outbreak was in 2014, and the work that you were doing there to expand community health workers was going on before that. I should acknowledge that. But take us back to how and when you were inspired to build this sort of army, as we said earlier, of community health workers in Liberia. I understand that it came from a model that you actually saw working in rural Alaska.
That's right. So community health workers, the idea that you could take someone that's not educated more than high school, sometimes middle to high school level, and give them within a matter of months some training to provide primary medical care supervised by a nurse or a physician, but going door to door in their own home communities to provide medical care for conditions like malaria, up to providing patients with HIV with treatment support. That is all possible to do. I had been exposed to this model in rural Alaska. In the tundra there in Bethel, Alaska, there have been for decades a number of remote rural communities that have employed local women and men who are not educated more than high school. To be the equivalent of community health workers who are providing at that time care for patients with high blood pressure, with conditions like mental illness. And so that inspired us. When I went back home to Liberia, I was seeing the same issue. You know, there's about 400 million to a billion people on the planet who do not have access to health care because they live too far from a clinic. And we thought, well, no one should die because they live too far from a clinic. Mm-hmm. Could we use a similar approach in Liberia to train our people, rural, local people, as community health workers? And so that's how we got started. And I'm happy to share an example of one that's useful. But, we've now managed to employ about over 300 of these community health professionals, including nurses to support them, serving about 50,000 people across 2.5 million acres of rainforest.
Oh, yeah. So I'd love an example. I mean, like, give us an example of what one of these workers have done, who they reach out to, what kind of work they do.
Sure. I just got back from Liberia this weekend. I was with one last week, a community health worker named Abadengo, and he is working in a community in an area called Riverses, where only 2 years ago there was an Ebola outbreak. And what Abadengo, the reason I was visiting him, and I had to take a canoe up river for about an hour and then hike through the forest for another hour to link up with him. Well, the reason I was visiting him was to follow up on a little baby, actually an infant, that he had found out was suffering from malnutrition. Imagine a child being 6 months old but only weighing what a one-month-old weighs. This was a child that was extremely emaciated when Abadengo found him back in February. He screened him for malnutrition, discovered that, in fact, this child was very malnourished, got him to a hospital. He was able to get medical care. He was discharged from the hospital back up the river through the forest. And then, of course, mom needed support. Mom, who was only 16 years old, needed support to support the child. So there's this ready-to-use therapeutic food, almost a peanut butter-like paste, that mom needed to give alongside the other food she was giving the child. And Abadengo was able to accompany her and make sure that she was able to feed the child. So I was there assessing his developmental milestones and happy to report, while he still has a lot of growth and recovery to do, he's meeting his developmental milestones. He's a little boy who can now, around the age of one, able to pull himself up with his hands to a stand, and is able to try and mouth some words. So, you know, that's one patient and one community health worker. What I didn't tell you is Abadengo is only eighth grade educated and has never had a chance to go beyond middle school. But yet he was able to, within a matter of months, learn some of the most important medical skills that could save the lives of children in his community.
Wow. Well, the Liberian government has recognized the power and success of the model of healthcare that you're helping launch there, and they're in the process of nationalizing it, I understand. Dr. Punjabi, we only have a couple minutes left, and I do want to ask you, you sort of hinted at it a little earlier that you had to leave Liberia as a child. You were, what, 9 years old then?
I was nine.
Yeah, and the country was on the brink of war, and you had to leave on a cargo plane. So, I mean, your own story is quite incredible as it is. So I'm just curious, every time you go back and you see the work that Abadengo and his colleagues are doing under your program, what does that mean to you?
You know, I think, you know, and this has been a year of such tumult for the world, I think what Liberia and that experience during the war and the coming back home has taught me is that we as people, we as patients, we as citizens, we're not defined by the crises that strike our lives. We're defined, in fact, by how we respond to them. Liberia was once known as a poster child for armies of child soldiers. I hope now, with the stories of people like Abadengo, if we can throw more support behind them, we'll be known for armies of compassion, full of nurses and community health workers who are able to reach patients anywhere and everywhere. So, you know, I think that's what being a physician has taught me. I'm really grateful to Harvard Medical School for training, for giving me the opportunity to learn and go back and be supportive of it, and grateful for my colleagues at Last Mile Health. But fundamentally, that's what I think I've learned from it.
Well, Dr. Raj Punjabi is CEO and co-founder of Last Mile Health and an associate physician at Harvard Medical School. Just this month, he was awarded the TED Prize, the 2017 TED Prize. It's worth $1 million. Are you allowed to tell us what organization or what you're going to use that $1 million for yet?
Well, it'll build on the work, but I'll announce it live from the TED stage in April, so tune in.
Okay. We'll definitely tune in and hope to have you back shortly after that. Dr. Punjabi, thank you so much and congratulations.
Thank you so much, Meg.
In 2015, the five states with the highest number of opioid-driven overdose deaths were West Virginia, New Hampshire, Kentucky, Ohio, and Rhode Island. But every state is touched by the toll drug addiction can take. And then there are the stories of the lucky ones, the addicts who survived and found a way to recovery. And some of those stories are resonating with Massachusetts high school students. This year alone, thousands of kids in the state have seen performances by a theater ensemble called The Improbable Players. They do theatrical adaptations of personal stories of all kinds of addiction, and all of the actors are in recovery. Deborah Becker from Here and Now contributor WBUR attended a recent performance focusing on opioid use and found this story.
You know, I hate you. I really, really hate you.
This soliloquy from the stage of the auditorium at Triton Regional High School in Byfield, Massachusetts, has more than 500 teenagers riveted as the actor describes powerful feelings about being a drug user, while three other actors whisper back, reinforcing those negative emotions.
Every time, your mom asks, how you doing? I'm doing fine, Mom. You lie!
This play, titled End of the Line, is based on stories from people in recovery from substance use disorders. It's something these actors know well, as they are all in recovery.
The world would be better off without you. And maybe you'd be better off dead.
The Improbable Players performed before 5,000 students in Massachusetts this school year alone because they say they want the students to know what the players learned the hard way, that it's easy to fall into addiction and hard to claw out of it. After the one-hour play, the performers tell their personal stories and then invite the students to ask questions.
We'd be happy to answer any of your questions about us, our personal lives, our addictions, the play itself.
The students ask questions such as, do you believe addiction is a disease? Do you think marijuana is a gateway drug? One student raised her hand and was overcome by emotion as she explained that her father had recently died from a heart attack after struggling with addiction for years. What could I have done? She asked the actors between sobs. And then, with a bit more edge in her voice, and why do you people who are addicts not listen to your loved ones and keep using drugs? What can we do to make you stop? The auditorium was completely silent for a moment. Actor Elizabeth Addison struggled to answer her.
Hearing that question was just like, it broke my heart.
Addison told the teen there wasn't much she could have done for her dad.
You think that telling him you love him or whatever is going to, you know, wake something up? No, it's a very tricky disease. The person that has it, is their mind is completely being fooled. It's completely someplace else. They're being literally like they're puppets.
She also told the young woman that statistics show that the fact that these actors can even perform at all is, well, improbable.
For the four of us, there's 398 people who are either institutionalized or in jail or going to die from the disease of addiction. So that is why we're called the Improbable Players, because it is improbable that us four would be up there. Given where we came from.
Since 1984, the Improbable Players have been taking the stories of people in recovery and staging them in short plays. First, the troupe focused on alcohol. Then, about 3 years ago, after Massachusetts declared opioid use a public health emergency, the troupe's founder, Lynn Bratley, says the group decided to do a play about it.
We had to do the opioid play. We absolutely had to. We answered a call to address this issue. It's just too devastating and serious.
And Bratley dismisses suggestions that her plays might make drug use seem normal or acceptable because these actors and their painful pasts are now in the limelight.
They don't make the addiction look glamorous. Not for one second. They make it look like what it is, painful and horrible. And and their own stories. It's not like they don't have consequences still today. They live with the consequences of their youth and use.
The main point of the program, Brantley says, is to get students talking about their lives and to let them know that opioids are a public health problem threatening thousands of families across the country. Triton senior Cassie McGrath says these types of programs are critical, not so much because they might stop someone from using drugs, but they'll get people talking about it.
It's something that when you're in high school, if like no one talks about it, and it will become more of a problem. I think that if like people don't address that opioids are actually happening in our area, because they really are, then no one will ever really do anything about it. And it just makes it even harder for people to reach out for help.
And the statistics continue to be alarming. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says more than 33,000 people died of an opioid overdose in 2015, and the number of deaths keeps rising. For Here and Now, I'm Deborah Becker.
And of course, this is a story we will continue to follow into 2017.